Hello, it's Tuesday the 13th of September and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The Korean series Squid Game has made TV history by winning two major Emmy Awards for director Hwang Dong-hyuk and actor Lee Jung-jae. We'll have more on this story in our news briefing shortly. North Korea enshrined into its law the right to use preemptive nuclear strikes if the regime is under attack last week. We take a look at this development for our in-depth today. And then coming up for Touch Base in Seoul, we talk to Justin Gutang, one of the first Filipino players to have joined the Korean Basketball League this year. Let's begin Korea 24.
The Emmy for lead actor in a drama series goes to Lee Jung-jae!
You're hearing sounds from a historic night at this year's Primetime Emmy Awards in Los Angeles. Two talents behind the Netflix global smash hit series Squid Game clinched top awards, marking a first for any non-English series in the Television Academy's seven-decade run. South Korean actor Lee Jung-jae was one of the winners for his lead role in the series. Here's what he had to say upon receiving his honor.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. First, I'd like to thank God above. And thank you to the Television Academy. And thank you to Netflix. And thank you to Director Hwang for making realistic problem we all face come to life so creatively on the screen with a great script and amazing visual.
Those audio clips come courtesy of the Academy of Television Arts and Science, so our thanks goes out to them for that. For more on this and our other headlines of the day, we welcome KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim to the studio. Eunice, hello.
Hello.
So two major wins for Squid Game, the first by a non-English language series, and that tops what has been a very strong run for the Netflix mega hit series.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, the other big winner of the night at the 74th Emmys at the Microsoft Theater Monday was none other than the creative genius behind Squid Game, director, writer, producer Hwang Dong-hyuk, who took home the honor for outstanding directing for a drama series for the first episode of the show entitled Red Light, Green Light. He thanked Netflix for opening the door to his all-Korean language show. Let's go ahead and take a listen to his acceptance speech.
Since Squid Game got 14 nominations at the Emmys, people keep telling me like I made the history. But I don't think I made the history by myself. Because it was you who opened up the doors for Squid Game, invited us here tonight at the Emmys. So I believe, I have to say, we made all history together. And I truly hope Squid Game won't be the last non-English series to be here at the Emmys. And I also hope this won't be my last Emmy either. I'll be back with season two. Thank you.
Hwang Dong-hyuk there, keeping it real. He and Lee Jung-jae together then become not only the first Korean, but the first Asian thespians to win top honors in their categories in the Television Academy's 76-year history. Once again, Lee won Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series for his rendition of the protagonist, Sung Ki-hun. Now, three other actors from Netflix's most-watched series were also nominated for a total of 14 nominations, including Emmy for Best Drama, which unfortunately did go to Succession. All in all then, including the four statuettes awarded at the Creative Arts Emmys last week for Outstanding Guest Actress, Outstanding Special Visual Effects, Outstanding Stunt Performance, and Outstanding Production Design. It was a strong and historic showing for the dystopic drama, and the team there bringing home a total of six Emmy statuettes.
Well, it's great to start our news briefing with some good news for a change. On that note, we turn now to some domestic issues of political consequence here in South Korea. Police say they will seek a third-party bribery charge against the head of the main opposition Democratic Party, Lee Jae-myung, for his alleged involvement in a pay-to-play scheme while he was mayor of Seongnam City. Can you tell us more?
Sure. The Gyeonggi Namdo Provincial Police Agency on Tuesday said it would seek that new charge of third-party bribery and recommend it to the prosecution. A supplementary probe had uncovered evidence of wrongdoing also by a Seongnam City employee and a former Doosan Engineering and Construction chairman identified by his surname E. The DP chief, who of course was the de facto owner of Seongnam FC while he was mayor of Seongnam City, he is accused of accepting 5.5 billion won in corporate donations for the football club from Doosan Group between 2014 and 2016 in return for business favors. Seongnam City is suspected of having rezoned some 9,900 square meters of Doosan-owned land in the city's Pundang district for commercial use in 2015. The conglomerate has since built offices at the site, which reportedly helped raise its value significantly.
Moving on now to North Korea, where days after its rubber-stamp parliament passed new laws on automatic nuclear strikes, the regime has issued a new propaganda showcasing its best weaponry.
Mm-hmm. The state-run Korean Central News Agency, also known as KCNA, on Monday unveiled 9 new posters with illustrations of the Norris hypersonic and Hwasong-12 intermediate-range missiles tested in January, as well as the Hwasong-15 and Hwasong-17 ICBMs fired in May. Another featured the regime's MiG-29 jets and an ICBM loaded on a transporter erector launcher. All this appears to be a show of resolve to never give up its nuclear arsenal, cementing statements by North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, who at last Thursday's meeting of the Supreme People's Assembly had said the state's, quote, nuclear forces will responsibly carry out their significant mission in deterring serious political and military provocations against Pyongyang by the U.S. and its followers. The rubber stamp parliament had passed legislation that requires its military to automatically launch nuclear strikes against enemy forces if its leadership comes under attack.
Meanwhile, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says there are indications of continued operation of the uranium enrichment facility at the Yongbyon nuclear site in North Korea. What more can you tell us?
Indeed, IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi presented that assessment in his introductory statement at a session of the agency's Board of Governors on Monday in Vienna. Grossi told the session that there are ongoing indications that the 5-megawatt reactor is operating, citing indications that the centrifuge enrichment facility at Yongbyon continues to operate and is now externally complete, expanding the building's available floor space by approximately one-third. Grossi also said there are indications tunnel number 3 at the Punggye-ri nuclear site has been reopened and that the site remains active and ready to support a test. He said that the agency has very recently observed renewed work on the road leading to tunnel number 4, characterizing the reopening of the nuclear test site as deeply troubling.
The South Korean presidential office, meanwhile, announced President Yoon Suk-yeol will be embarking on a week-long overseas trip next Sunday. He's bound for the UK, the US, and also Canada. Can you give us more details?
Yes, as yesterday was the last day of the 4-day Chuseok holiday, it was National Security Advisor Kim Song-han who made that announcement. He confirmed the president will be making a 7-day journey from September 18, starting with the United Kingdom, where he and the First Lady would, of course, attend the funeral, the state funeral of Queen Elizabeth II, who passed away last Thursday after a lifetime of service at the age of 96. Yoon will then visit New York City, where he will make his first address as South Korea's leader at the United Nations General Assembly. He could have some sideline meetings with U.S. President Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. A meeting with Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is also set to be in the works.
And finally, let's get a check on the daily COVID-19 caseload. We did observe a slight dip in the early days of the four-day Chuseok holiday, but now authorities will be watching for a potential uptick in new infections, given all the moving around during the holiday.
Yeah, on this Tuesday, the KDCA said the daily tally had risen by more than 20,000 day over day to come in at 57,309 cases. That includes 272 from overseas. It is still a drop of 42,000 week over week, however, and the lowest tally in 9 weeks for a Tuesday.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
You bet.
North Korea marked the 74th anniversary of its founding on September 9th. A day earlier, the North's official Korean Central News Agency said that the reclusive state passed a new law declaring itself a nuclear weapons state. The law also enshrines the right to use preemptive nuclear strikes to protect itself. In a speech delivered on Thursday during a meeting of the Supreme People's Assembly, leader Kim Jong-un reiterated the importance of the regime's nuclear arsenal. Here's more from that speech.
Let them impose sanctions on us for 100 days, 1,000 days, 10 years or 100 years. We will not give up our right to life and right to defend our country, on which the future and safety of our people depend. Our republic's nuclear forces will responsibly carry out their significant mission in deterring serious political and military provocations against us by the U.S. and its followers and manage future threats. And we stipulate this in the national law today.
To get some expert analysis on what this new law means for the peace process on the Korean Peninsula, we have joining us on the line now Professor Robert Kelly from the Department of Political Science and Diplomacy at Busan National University. Professor Kelly, hello, and thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me again.
First off, what do you read into this new law? How significant a change is this?
Well, given that North Korea is really not a rule of law state, right? I mean, given that it's basically a dictatorship where sort of law flows from a very tiny elite at the top, I mean, codifying in this way doesn't really make any difference because you could switch it back immediately if Kim Jong-un and the people around him so chose. So I think this is really more sort of for rhetorical value, right? This is sort of reinforced for us, the rest of the world, that North Korea is not going to give up its nuclear weapons, that these things are sort of non-negotiable. And it sort of signals to the South Korean or to the North Korean public as well that the nuclear weapons are of great importance. But I mean, the idea that it's sort of like legally binding in the way that, say, South Korea would be, you know, legally bound if its National Assembly passed a law about XYZ. I mean, that just doesn't exist in North Korea. So I'm not really sure because, like, you know, supposedly North Korea wrote its nuclear weapons into its constitution a few years ago. And, you know, people sort of made a bit of a fuss about it, but then it kind of faded away in part because, you know, these kinds of things are very malleable in North Korea. So I wouldn't see really as a legal statement, but more of as a rhetorical one that the nukes are here to stay.
Right. Even though if you consider it a rhetorical statement, the law specifies when they feel they will have the right to use nuclear force. In fact, they laid out five conditions for using weapons of mass destruction. Could you briefly tell us the gist of these conditions and what you make of them?
Well, my sense is that most of it is defensively minded, although I think the really big issue is the preemption, right? I mean, if the North Koreans actually feel that they're entitled to use nuclear weapons preemptively, that's going to sort of provoke a really severe backlash, right, among North Korea's counterparts. I wonder if the Chinese are actually going to come along with that, and I think it will help motivate the South Korean nuclear debate, which is something that's really sort of accelerated this year. I also wonder if the North Koreans would be willing to use nuclear weapons sort of as a step up on a conventional conflict, right? I mean, this is a discussion about Vladimir Putin doing the same thing in Ukraine, right? That if he's really loses, he sort of reach for nuclear weapons as sort of a last-ditch gamble, sort of to the tactical outcomes on the battlefield. And I wonder if the North Koreans, because we've heard the North Koreans talk before about the development of tactical nuclear weapons as well. So those are the two things that would worry me. I mean, the big things that are already sort of in place, right, sort of deterrence of the United States, you saw that in the speech, right, that we sort of reserve the right to use them against the Americans. I think that's been understood since 2017, since they had the ICBM that could strike the United States. I think that has always been the core argument for the nuclear weapons is they could provide strategic deterrence against the Americans. And then you have these other sort of newer issues, right? Do they actually reserve the right to use them first, which would be very destabilizing? And the North Koreans have been hinting at that for a while. And again, you heard that in the speech. And then would they also use them if they were losing a traditional conventional conflict? South Koreans and North Koreans started shooting each other with tanks and artillery, and the North Koreans were losing, which they probably would. Would they then use the nukes as sort of a last-ditch effort to win a traditional conflict?
What do you think is Kim's motive behind this new law, and how much does this raise tensions, do you think?
I don't actually think that the letter one is, I think, a little bit easier. I'm not actually sure that it really changes the nuclear debate about North Korea as much as sort of the technological steps forward, right? It's the technological steps, right? The ability to develop an ICBM that can strike the United States, the ability to develop sort of smaller nuclear weapons that can be used on the battlefield, which the North Koreans have hinted at. It's those kinds of technological steps that raise the ability of the North Koreans to use these things in combat. I don't know. I mean, maybe others think that, like, North Korean rhetoric is actually meaningful. I tend not to. I tend to think that KCNA, the Korean Central News Agency, says all sorts of outlandish stuff, you know, turning Seoul into a sea of fire. And a lot of it is sort of meant for rhetorical to frighten us and to sort of show to their own population how strong they are. I don't actually think those are intended as serious operational guidelines. I'm not actually sure that North Koreans actually know under what circumstances they would use these things, because nobody actually knows what would happen in world politics if you detonated a nuclear weapon against an enemy state. I mean, nobody knows how the Americans would respond. Nobody knows how the South Koreans would respond. So my sense is that these things are not sort of like lines in the sand about, like, you know, we use these under them, under these sorts of precise conditions, right? My sense is that, you know, again, I mean, this has been an evolving threat for a long time. We've known the North Koreans have been moving towards these things for a while, and this is another step forward. Now they're talking about preemption, which is actually a really big threat. It's going to encourage South Korea to build its own nuclear weapons, right? But I'm not actually sure that this is some, like, major operational change. This indicates that the North Koreans are suddenly going to be more aggressive in the way deal with South Korea, that they might be willing to take more conventional risks along the demilitarized zone. I don't draw that. Because North Korea is not really a rule of law state where these kinds of things actually have real policy import, because that's not how policy is made in North Korea, right? The Supreme People's Assembly is a rubber stamp. So giving a speech in front of it doesn't strike me as particularly important in terms of sort of like legal or operational or doctrinal significance, right? This is more sort of political.
Well, in the meantime, this comes amid the Yoon administration promising the North Korean regime a bold initiative focusing on economic benefits in return for denuclearization. Where do you think this latest development leaves the Yoon administration's bold initiative?
Yeah, well, it strikes me as the same thing that the Lee Myung-bak administration offered way back. If you remember, the Lee Myung-bak administration offered the North Koreans sort of like, if I remember what it was, to sort of like help elevate their GDP to something like 5 or 10,000 per capita or something like that, gave up nuclear weapons. There was this kind of direct enticement of sort of, you know, economic aid from the Lee administration if the North Koreans went for denuclearization and they passed it up. I would be surprised if they take up the offer this time, right? I think their big chance for denuclearization was when Donald Trump and Moon Jae-in were president in South Korea and the United States. Both of them were very committed to a peace deal with North Korea. Both of them were very willing to make major concessions, and the North Koreans passed up that chance. So my sense is the North Koreans won't make any major concessions to a more hawkish government like the Yoon administration. The Yoon people should keep trying. I mean, the best chance we have is to sort of buy the North, in my opinion, the best chance we have to get the North Koreans away from their nukes is to buy them out. I think strategic concessions to North Korea probably at this point are too late. I think basically they want like a lot of money and a lot of aid and sort of like reintegration with the world economy and things like that. But, you know, the North Koreans are going to ask for a lot. They're not going to give nuclear weapons for like, I don't know, $100 billion in aid or something like that. They're going to ask for an enormous amount more, right? And they're going to want, you know, some kind of deal from the Americans and the Japanese to throw in money as well. So the Yoon people should try, but the price tag is going to be, I think, much greater than the South Korean public would tolerate.
Could this new law be interpreted as a rejection of Yoon's overtures?
I don't know. I'm just not sure. I'm just not sure how much stake we should put into sort of like legislation, quote unquote, that comes out of the Supreme People's Assembly. Because my sense is that North Korean institutions are so paper thin because the country is really dominated by this family elite. That's what really matters, right? What does Kim Jong-un's sister say? That means a great deal more than what the Supreme People's Assembly says, to my mind. But yes, I mean, in principle, yeah, it does, right? I mean, North Koreans wouldn't be talking this way if they were going to take the offer seriously. So yeah, I mean, I think the Yoon people anticipate this. I don't think the Yoon people really believe that the North Koreans are going to suddenly come forward. They had their big chance under Moon and they passed it up. I mean, I think What the UN people are probably doing is putting this out at first, sort of say, look, the North Koreans brush it off, and then we have to step up to things like that or improved kill chain. You know what I mean? The UN people very clearly want to bring another THAAD battery in, and that's because of the way the North Koreans are talking. But at least they have to offer the olive branch to establish the moral high ground, particularly vis-a-vis China. When the Chinese say you can't have, you shouldn't do another THAAD battery, UN be able to say, look, we tried with the North Koreans. We offered them all this economic aid for the first 6 months or a year, something like that. They blew it off, and now we have no choice but to do missile defense. So, I doubt the UN people think that the North Koreans were going to move on it. It's probably designed to lay the groundwork for, you know, more defensive measures, particularly missile defense.
Mm. So how does then South Korea and the United States respond to North Korea's latest move? There's a high-level deterrence dialogue coming up this week after a hiatus of 4 years and 8 months. So the Extended Deterrence Strategy and Consultation Group, that will be held in Washington this Friday. What kind of things do you think they'll be talking about there?
Yeah, I think the big issue coming up is how do we respond to the total unwillingness of the North Koreans to give up their nuclear weapons, right? And the big issue will be, can we build enough defense to actually provide some kind of like meaningful roof or some kind of ability for South Korea to block weapons? Or I think increasingly what you're seeing from the South Korean side, the question that always sort of expanded, is whether or not South Korea should build sort of its own deterrence. So far, the South Korean government has sort of danced around that, but there's a lot of sort of track two discussion out there now from Korean academics at conferences and stuff like that, saying, you know, we're just kind of getting to the point where we really don't have any choice anymore but to do this kind of thing, right? You know, the North Koreans don't step back from building all these weapons, right, particularly all these missiles, then it's not really clear what South Korea's options are, right? I mean, the Americans are going to keep saying extended deterrence means that the United States is going to stumble into a nuclear war with North Korea. That's kind of iffy. You know, would the Americans be willing to do that? Are the Americans going to get nuked to fight a war for a foreign country? I don't know. And so that's kind of the debate here, right? But the next step before we get to that sort of crisis point, I think, is a lot more missile defense. And the real debate is going to be getting the Chinese to agree with it, which is probably why the UN people are making this offer, right, to sort of establish their bona fides in order to, you know, fight the Chinese over increased missile defense here in South Korea.
Yes, the line is breaking up a bit, but hopefully we can keep hold of you for the next few minutes.
Sorry about that.
Okay. No apologies. In the background to all this at the moment is, of course, the long-mooted seventh nuclear test. It's been reported for several months now that North Korea is ready for a nuclear test, and that it's a matter of when, not if. We got another reminder on Monday from Rafael Grossi, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who said that there are indications of continued operation of the uranium enrichment facility at the Yongbyon nuclear site in North Korea. Do you think North Korea is on the brink of carrying out a nuclear test? And what do you think would prompt such a move?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of surprised that this hasn't happened, because we heard a lot from the intelligence community in both the U.S. and South Korea in the beginning of the year. In the first like 4 or 5 months, there was a lot of talk there would be number seven. But at this point, to be honest, I'm not really sure. I wonder if the North Koreans are feeling like maybe they need to go slow on this, because I think the discussion about South Korean defense is changing and it's becoming a little bit more sort of extreme. I think the South Koreans are getting genuinely nervous that the North Koreans just aren't pulling over on the program. And I think people are beginning to entertain more and more sort of what you might otherwise see as radical options. I mean, remember that when Yoon was running for president, he advocated preemptive strikes on North Korean missile sites in a crisis. I mean, no South Korean politician has ever talked like that before. And I think the Yoon people kind of pulled back from that because it's like so risky. But I mean, this is kind of an indication of where South Korea is going. And South Korea is really naked against the North Korean missile strike. It really is. South Korea doesn't have enough missile defense. Missile defense doesn't work well enough, which is why the Yoon people are talking like this. That's like I said, I mean, that's why you're seeing this kind of track two discussion about South Korea's own nuclearization cropping up in the last 6 months or so. Right. And I think if I were the North Koreans, I would see that as a real Rubicon. And I have the feeling also the Chinese are kind of worried about that, too, and probably telling the North Koreans to hold off. But I mean, at some point, if the North Koreans are going to keep an active nuclear arsenal, if they're going to do what this law says they're going to do, then, yeah, they're going to have to do another nuclear test. But I have the feeling that another nuclear test is going to be, like I said, a sort of a Rubicon in South Korea that's really going to push the South Korean defense debate significantly to the right. And it's going to encourage the entertainment of a lot more radical options about how South Korea should respond. Because at this point, it doesn't look like the North Koreans are ever going to give up their weapons, which puts you guys in a really, really tight spot. It means you're entirely reliant on the United States for nuclear defense. And that is a risky proposition. And again, that's why Yoon was saying what he was saying. And so, you know, if you're the North Koreans, I have a feeling that maybe that might be why they're sort of holding back, because it could be interpreted as really shifting the debate here in the South.
You talk about a radical response. A key South Korean diplomat said Seoul, Washington and Tokyo will come up with a quote-unquote unprecedented response to a seventh nuclear test by North Korea. The official briefed reporters last Thursday in Tokyo on the results of the meeting between the chief nuclear envoys of the three sides held the previous day in Japan. Sounds rather ominous. What kind of unprecedented response do you think they could be talking about?
Yeah, that is a really, really good question. The most obvious thing to do would be a major step up in missile defense, right? I mean, the best way to respond to North Korea's nuclear weapons would be to have enough missile defense and good missile defense technology to actually shoot down North Korean missiles, right? I mean, the best thing to do would be to build a roof, for lack of a better word. The problem is missile defense doesn't work well enough, right? Which is why Yoon entertained the idea of preemptive strikes. I wonder if that's what people are going to go for. I mean, we know the Americans oppose the nuclearization of South Korea and Japan. The Americans have said this repeatedly. They said it at this whole defense dialogue 2 weeks ago again, right? So I'm wondering what other options there are. Does this mean like sabotage of the North Korean nuclear program? You know, the Israelis did that to the Iranian program, right? But I have the feeling that penetrating the North Korean program would probably be a lot harder because North Korea is a full-blown totalitarian state, right? It could mean preemptive strikes. I mean, the Yoon people already floated that, although there are a lot of people who are real uncomfortable with that idea. I don't know. I mean, it's not really clear to me. I mean, if we had a great way to slow or pull over the North Korean nuclear program, you know, some big unprecedented thing, we probably would have, right? So I'm just not really sure. I mean, just load up THAAD batteries in South Korea and Japan. I have a feeling that might be the unprecedented, lots more missile defense, a lot more Patriot missiles and THAAD. That would be my guess, because the other alternatives are fairly extreme. I mean, bombing North Korea preemptively is like a huge risk, right? I don't know.
Okay, very briefly, can I get your thoughts on the South Korean government's proposal to North Korea that they hold talks to address the issue of separated families?
Yeah, the good thing about separated families, I mean, strategically, I mean, first of all, humanitarianly, we should always, for humanitarian reasons, we should always try to reunite the families. The humanitarian argument for that is important, and South Korea, the U.S., Japan, we're liberal states, and we believe in that because it's important for its own sake, right? Strategically, though, there's a good argument for humanitarian reunifications, family reunifications, because what it does is it helps to create some kind of momentum of cooperation between two Koreas that is somewhat apolitical, and it hopefully creates some space for sort of confidence building that could allow you to step up to other things that are more contentious. So I think the humanitarian argument for it is very clear. I'm a strong believer in it. We should do that because it's the right thing to do for the families on both sides, but I think there's also a strategic value to it, which, you know, we can use it to sort of push the North Koreans along towards some cooperation.
And finally, what would steer North Korea back to dialogue? Some observers have also pointed out the importance of keeping talks alive with China and Russia in terms of North Korea as well, pointing out the importance of deterring a unity among North Korea, Russia and China, which would deal a blow to South Korea's diplomacy. And that's despite Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the tensions between the U.S. and China. How doable is that, especially when Russia has been shunned globally and getting too close to China risks upsetting the U.S.?
Yeah, I think Russia and China are increasingly drifting away from our ability to rope them in on stuff. I mean, you know, China's behavior in East Asia is increasingly belligerent. Russia has basically become a pariah under Putin. I mean, you know, the world economy is not going to really bring the Russians back in until Putin is gone. I mean, Putin can trade with, you know, states that have sort of like mixed feelings about the world economy, Russia or China and India most likely, the Russians will never be able to properly reintegrate into Western financial institutions as long as Putin is in there. And South Korea is really tied into those institutions as a major non-NATO ally for the United States and as a participant in that global economy. So, you know, I think, you know, Russia will be on the outs with basically all the modern advanced democracies for a while. But I also don't think that's a big loss because I don't think Russia actually is a big party. I know others dispute that. I think the real issue, though, is China. And China is on the fence, in part because the Russians are now very obviously losing in Ukraine, right, which is a good thing. If the Ukrainians win, that makes it harder for the Chinese to get much value out of the Russian alliance. But, I mean, the larger issue of sort of China in East Asia, I mean, the relations are souring between China and the U.S. and Japan, to a certain extent also with South Korea. I mean, Yoon's made it very clear that he doesn't accept the Chinese veto over THAAD. And all that's going to make it much harder to get the Chinese to help on North Korea. But that said, you know, the Chinese have been telling us for 25 years that they can't actually get North Korea to change. So, I mean, I'm not sure how true that is. I do actually think China has some levers they could pull and don't. But, I mean, if the Chinese are right, that they can't help us that much on North Korea, that North Korea is an American problem or a South Korean problem. That's what they always say when I need global television. That's what they always tell me, right? It's your problem. If that's true, then it doesn't really make any difference if the Chinese don't like us because they're not doing anything. So I'm not exactly convinced that China can deliver North Korea. And I'm not really sure the Chinese even want to. I think the Chinese like the North Korea, sort of like a finger in the eye of Japan, South Korea, and the United States. So I'm not even sure that the Chinese really want to come along with this.
Well, Professor Kelly, we appreciate your time and for talking through these issues with us today. We'll be speaking to Professor Robert Kelly from the Busan National University. Thank you once again for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 65.26 points, or 2.74% on Tuesday, closing the day at 2,449.54. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 18.98 points, or 2.44%, to close at 796.79. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 7.21 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,373.61. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We carry on now to Korea Trending, our daily segment looking at some of the other news stories that have been trending online today. And joining us in the studio today to bring us those stories is Jenny Ha. Jenny, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, Jung.
Okay, so what topics do you have for us today?
First, we'll talk about the new rules put in place for Queen Elizabeth II's lying in state at Westminster Hall. Then we'll explore an amendment that has been submitted to help improve employees' work-life balance in South Korea. And finally, we'll discuss the golden boy Lee Kang-in's return to the men's national soccer team.
Okay, so we start with an international headline today. Tens of thousands have already visited St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh to pay respects to Queen Elizabeth, who passed away last week, of course. But even more are expected to see her when her body is moved to London. Can you tell us more?
Yes, the British government has published a set of security guidelines for Queen Elizabeth II's lying in state, which will be held from Wednesday. These guidelines come as around 750,000 people are expected to attend the memorial at Westminster Hall in London after Britain's longest reigning monarch passed away last Thursday.
Yes, so a huge crowd expected, understandably, as this is a significant moment in British history. Mm-hmm. It's been calculated that more than 85% of the country has known only one monarch. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned, the Queen's coffin is currently in Scotland, right?
Yes. On Sunday, the coffin was taken from Balmoral Castle to the Palace of Holyrood House in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. The Queen's body will lie at rest in St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh before being flown to Buckingham Palace in London on Tuesday. The coffin will then be taken to the Palace of Westminster on Wednesday, where it will be open to the public until the day before her funeral.
And there are new security guidelines put in place then?
Mm-hmm. For the current vigil at St. Giles Cathedral, the Scottish government told visitors to be prepared to stand in long lines and has urged them not to stop in front of the coffin and move quickly so that as many people as possible can pay their respects to the Queen. And the British government predicts that the line to pay respects would stretch up to 8 kilometers for the upcoming service at Westminster, and the waiting time alone could reach 20 hours. And only small bags are allowed for mourners visiting Westminster grounds, and food and drinks are prohibited. Flowers and candles will also be banned, as well as cameras. The British government also said it could halt the mourning procession if it becomes overcrowded.
Also here in Seoul, the British Embassy has opened its doors for people who want to sign a public condolence book for her. It will run until Friday, and the embassy has said all are welcome to visit without an appointment. An online condolence book is also available, so for those in Korea who also want to pay their respects, they can do that in those ways too. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to our next story. What else has been trending today?
Employees in South Korea could be moving one step closer to a better work-life balance as an amendment banning messages and calls outside of work hours has been submitted. Lawmaker Dong-lee of the Democratic Party of Korea announced on Monday that he proposed a partial amendment to the Labor Standards Act, which would ban out-of-hours work orders across various communication channels, including telephone calls, text messages, and messenger apps.
Okay, so what are the specifics of the amendment?
Repetitive and continuous work orders outside of working hours will be regulated, and a violation will result in a fine of up to 5 million won. That's around $3,600. And Dong added that the amount of the fine will fend off claims of overregulation while improving the effectiveness of the law. And in 2016, South Korea followed countries like France, Portugal, and the Philippines with a right to disconnect bill that was proposed at the 20th National Assembly, but it was thrown out due to criticisms of excessive regulation.
Yes, work orders after work and even on weekends and holidays have been raised as a problem for years, but the situation hasn't gotten much better, has it?
Not really. There have been movements to improve work-life balance, mainly around large corporations, by banning work-related KakaoTalk messages after 10 p.m. However, the majority of office workers are still complaining of stress due to messages after work. And with the rise of remote working during the COVID-19 pandemic, work orders through messenger apps have increased even further. And according to a survey by the labor civic organization Work Gapjil 119, higher-ranking managers said they saw no problem with giving orders outside of working hours and during holidays. Noh said these types of orders should be viewed as a form of workplace bullying and harassment, which infringes on employees' personal time and right to rest.
Right, as you mentioned, a similar bill was submitted in 2016, but actually getting it passed through the National Assembly is, of course, another challenge. We'll see if there is more luck with this amendment, as it is a real problem in Korean society that many people would like to see changed. Okay, let's move on to our final trending story. What do you have for us?
South Korean soccer's golden boy, Lee Kang-in, will be returning to the men's national team's roster after 1 year and 6 months ahead of the 2022 World Cup in Qatar in November. Coach Paulo Bento announced on Tuesday the 26-member roster for the friendly matches against Costa Rica on September 23rd at Goyang Stadium in Goyang, and Cameroon on September 27th at Seoul World Cup Stadium.
Yes, so these two upcoming games are the final tests to see who will go to Qatar. It's interesting to see Lee being picked again after such a lengthy period. There have been a lot of calls for him to be picked during that time, as he is one of Korea's brightest prospects. Can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Yes, the RCD Mallorca player is nicknamed the Golden Boy for his 2019 FIFA Under-20 World Cup Golden Ball Award win. He made his national team debut in a friendly match against Georgia in September 2019 and was a regular feature for the team until March last year. The 21-year-old has had a strong start to the season in the Spanish La Liga this year with 1 goal and 3 assists in 4 consecutive games.
Yes, Bento is the one who first called Lee to the national team, but it's been 1 year and 6 months since he was last picked. What's the story behind that, do we know?
Yes, Lee has been left off of Bento's roster since a 3-0 loss against Japan. The national team's overall performance came under fire, but the 21-year-old's overall contribution was pointed out specifically as one of the reasons for the loss. And regarding his decision, Bento said he selected Lee after a comprehensive consideration of performance and whether he meets the team's requirements as he did for the other players. And there was another surprise pick for the upcoming evaluation games as Gangwon FC's Yang Hyun-jun was included in the 26-man roster. The 19-year-old, who made his professional debut last year, has scored 8 goals and made 4 assists so far in the K-League 1 this season.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see what these two players can contribute and whether they'll be able to grab this final opportunity to get on the plane for Qatar. We'll leave it there for today's Career Trending. Thank you for those stories, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
In April, the Korean Basketball League decided to expand its Asian player quota system to include players from the Philippines. Previously, the system was limited to Japanese players only. Since then, teams have been quick to sign new players from the Philippines, and one player we'll be seeing on the courts during the upcoming season is forward Justin Gutang of the LG Sakers, who's known for his great ability to score and rebound. To hear more about his journey to the KBL, his goals and what we can expect from him as well, we welcome Mr. Gutang for Touch Base and Seoul today via video call. Hello, and thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you again for having me.
Yes, so well, Mr. Gutang, first let me say welcome to Korea. How have you found your time in Korea so far?
It's been quite lovely. Everyone here is so nice and so caring and all open with welcome arms. So everything's been great so far.
Had you been to Korea before your arrival here?
This has been my first time, so to be able to experience this is a blessing for sure.
Sure. Well, it's wonderful to have you here in Korea. I'm sure Korean basketball fans are curious to see you on the court. For our listeners, could you briefly tell us about your basketball career before coming to South Korea?
So I played 2 years of college basketball in the States before transferring over to the Philippines to play college, the rest of my basketball career in college over there. And then after COVID hit, I decided to forego my last year in college to play in a couple pro leagues in the Philippines, such as MPBL or PhilBasket. And that's kind of how I started my professional career. And then now I got recruited by LG Sakers after my PhilBasket season. And now I'm here, South Korea.
And I understand you won some MVP awards as well in the Philippines.
Yes, I won my MVP award my first season in PhilBasket. And I have a lot of thanks to Jai Reyes for the opportunity.
So it seems you had been building a successful career in the Philippines. What made you want to come to Korea then?
Well, I obviously pay attention to other Asian basketball leagues, such as Japan B League or KBL. And I've gotten offers from B League as well. And I chose Korea just because I felt like the competition here was higher and I could develop into the next level as a player here.
So you'd been following the KBL quite closely from the Philippines then?
Yes, yes.
And what was your impression of the league?
It's very different. The play style here is very different than in the Philippines. It's a lot more systematic. Everything's much more at a much more faster pace. So to be able to experience this play style and learn from it, take in everything I can.
When you say systematic, what do you mean by that?
There's a lot of set plays, a lot of timing, and nothing really is much of freestyle basketball. It's more of a system within the coach. So, and that's a play style of basketball that I like as well, and I feel I could fit into that program. Mm.
So the styles are quite different. It's a different game in the Philippines than in Korea. You're confident you can adjust then?
I am confident I could adjust. I just have to give my all and have trust into the system and into the coaches.
And how does it compare to, you said you played college basketball in the U.S. as well, right?
Yes. Yeah. College basketball in the U.S. is just, everyone's much taller than me, more athletic. And I'd say just everyone is like gifted or skilled in the U.S. And over here, it's more of playing as a team, from what I learned. So everyone is, involved. Everyone's working together. And yeah, it's all very systematic.
So you're one of several players from the Philippines who have joined teams in the KBL for the upcoming season. I believe there are six or so far who have signed. What do you think the players from the Philippines can add to the KBL?
I don't know if you're familiar with the word puso. It means heart, and that's what a lot of Filipino basketball players can bring or offer to the table. And I feel like that is the main thing that we'll be able to showcase in this upcoming KBL season.
Have you
just
spoken
a lot of heart, energy, and just the will to not give up?
Have you spoken to the other players who have come to Korea? What have they been saying?
I have not, unfortunately. I've been busy and I had a lot on my hands. I'm sure they do as well, with a bunch of paperwork and trying to get over here. It's been a process, but I believe I'm still the only one out here, if I'm not wrong. Yeah, so I haven't been able to reach out to them or communicate with them as well.
Sure, I'm sure you'll get the opportunity once they do come. As you said, you're one of the first to come to Korea. You've joined up with your team, the LG Sakers. How has it been so far? What's your impression of the team so far in the first few days?
I didn't think I would be able to gel with them so quickly. Everyone has the same goal. They're all so kind and welcoming. A bunch of them have tried their best to speak English and try to communicate with me. Obviously, the language barrier is a big factor here, but they've been taking me under their wing and throwing me around, and for that, I'm just thankful.
What do you think it's about the team that's made you guys gel so well?
I think there's a lot of us, a lot of young guys. You know, we're around the same age, and we pretty much have the same goals, just to bring back the winning culture at LG Sakers. And I think that's what makes us strong. And then just being together pretty much from morning till night is also a huge help with our chemistry and bonding. Mm.
And how has it been with the coaching staff? You talked about how there's a different style of play. Has the training been different? Have you felt that change already?
Yeah, the training is definitely different from what I've experienced in the Philippines. Here it's training from morning to afternoon and night, and then cycle repeats, and it's constant basketball every day. So, and that's what I enjoy. So, and then the coaches have been, you know, doing their best to help me catch up, and they've been so patient with me.
So what is it that you've been working on the most for you personally?
For me personally, I've just been trying to, you know, get ready to, you know, be in the shape that I want to be for KBL season, and just still learning the system or the offense that coach has been trying to instill for us. And that's pretty much just trying to get better as well and be able to offer what I can to the team.
I'm sure you'll adjust quickly. What do you think your strengths are that you can bring to the team? What can Korean fans look forward to on the court in the upcoming season?
I could provide highlights, exciting plays like dunks, or as well as energy, defense, pretty much everything, whatever Coach Cho asks, I'll be able to deliver for him.
Sure, as he said, I'm sure the fans are going to be excited to see you play. Finally, the new season begins in October. What do you hope to achieve in the upcoming season?
Like I said earlier, we all have that same goal of bringing back the winning culture here at LG Stakers. I know they haven't made it to the playoffs in the past five seasons, so we try to take it day by day. Obviously, we all want to win a championship, but for now, I think we should... All right, we're focusing on just trying to get better and stay together as a team.
Well, I hope you adjust quickly and hope you Hope we make you feel welcome here in Korea as well, and we look forward to seeing you on the court soon. We'll leave it there. We were speaking to Justin Gutang of the LG Seikers. Thank you once again for your time today.
Thank you again for having me.
You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio. If you ever miss an episode of Korea 24, you can always catch up by downloading our podcasts. iOS users can simply search for Korea 24 on iTunes or the podcast app to download previous episodes of the show. For those of you who listen to our show through the KBS Kong app, you can listen to our podcasts from there as well. Tap the menu icon on the top left corner of the screen and you'll see the podcast option there. Then, use the drop-down menu to select Korea 24 on KBS World Radio and download the desired episode. You can always listen to our previous episodes on our website too. And don't forget to follow our Twitter page at KBS Korea 24 to get the latest updates on our show every day.
We finish up now, as usual, with our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And for that, we have joining us in the studio now our staff editor, Richard Larkin. Richard, hello. It's good to see you again.
Hello, good to see you too.
Okay, so where are we headed to first?
First, we'll take a look at the entertainment and arts section of the Korea Times. Dong Sunwa's article explains how KCON will be held in Saudi Arabia for the first time later this month. KCON 2022 Saudi Arabia is hosted by the entertainment and media company CJENM and will take place at the largest entertainment complex in the country's capital from September 30th to October 1st.
Right, KCON, for those who don't know, is the world's largest K-pop and culture convention, and it's known for often featuring popular acts from South Korea.
That's right. This will be the second time the convention will be held this year, after KCON in Los Angeles, which was held in August. At the time, it was also live-streamed online and attracted more than 700 million people.
Mm.
For the upcoming convention, high-profile acts such as ATEEZ, NewJeans, Stacey and The Boys will perform. A CJENM official said that over the past 10 years, KCON has played a pivotal role in globalizing Korean culture in the US and Japan. They added that it is now looking to expand its popularity in the Middle East and Europe.
And I understand there was a particular reason why the company chose Saudi Arabia as well.
There is. The biggest reason was to do with geography. The country connects Asia and Africa and is relatively close to Eastern Europe. So the company is hoping that Korean culture would expand beyond the region. Also, according to the article, Saudi Arabia is a young country where half of the population is under 30 years old. And K-pop is popular online, particularly among young people.
Yes, there is a particularly fervent following in that region. So it sounds like this event is going to be quite a big deal. Let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us?
Next, we'll look at the culture section of the Korea Herald. Kim Hae-yeon's article tells us more about the Royal Culture Festival, which will kick off on October 1st. The fall edition of the festival will run from October 19th and will take place at four palaces in Seoul. And those are Gyeongbokgung, Changdeokgung, Changgyeonggung, and Deoksu-gung.
Yeah, so this is another popular festival in South Korea and has attracted a lot of visitors.
It has. The article states that the festival has attracted 3.8 million visitors since its start in 2015, and there are many programs and performances to experience. These include culinary programs, traditional court music performances, and more. On the first day at Gyeongbokgung Palace, visitors can try royalty confectionaries and sample royal court cuisine. All the dishes are based on food from the Joseon Dynasty. They can also enjoy traditional games played at royal courts and look at various crafts on display. These are just some of the things you can do on the first day.
Right, I believe tickets haven't gone on sale yet though, right?
They haven't. Tickets can be bought for each program from Thursday on Interpark. The number of tickets may vary depending on the program, and prices range from 5,000 to 100,000 won. That's around $3 to $70. These are so many things that visitors can do. So if you want to find out more information about each program, you can check out the article.
Yes, that's in the Korea Herald. That's where we'll leave it for our Morning Edition Preview segment. Richard, thank you for bringing us the stories.
Thank you.
And that's where we wrap up our show. Thanks for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
내가 사랑하는 사람 정호승.
The people I love by 정호승.
나는 그늘이 없는 사람을 사랑하지 않는다. 나는 그늘을 사랑하지 않는 사람을 사랑하지 않는다. 나는 한 그루 나무의 그늘이 된 사람을 사랑한다.
I do not love people who have no shadows. I do not love people who do not love shadows. I love people who have become the shade beneath a tree.
햇빛도 그늘이 있어야 맑고 눈이 부시다. 나무 그늘에 앉아 나뭇잎 사이로 반짝이는 햇살을 바라보면 세상은 그 얼마나 아름다운가.
Sunlight too needs shade to shine bright and dazzle the eyes. Sitting in the shade of a tree and watching the sunlight sparkling between the leaves, how beautiful the world is then.
눈물이 없는 사람을 사랑하지 않는다. 나는 눈물을 사랑하지 않는 사람을 사랑하지 않는다. 나는 한 방울 눈물이 된 사람을 사랑한다.
I do not love people who have no tears. I do not love people who do not love tears. I love people who have become one teardrop.
기쁨도 눈물이 없으면 기쁨이 아니다. 사랑도 눈물 없는 사랑이 어디 있는가? 나무 그늘에 앉아 다른 사람의 눈물을 닦아주는 사람의 모습은 그 얼마나 고요한 아름다움인가?
Joy too is no joy without tears. And is there ever love without tears? The sight of someone sitting in the shade of a tree, wiping away another's tears. What serene beauty that is!
You've listened to Korean poet Jung Ho-sung's Naega Sarang Hanun Saram, The People I Love, read by An Jae-woo and translated by Brother Anthony of Tays and Son Jae. KBS World Radio brings the beauty of Korean poetry to the world. Don't even think about checking that message or texting back. Did you know it only takes 3 seconds after a driver's attention has been diverted from the road for a crash to occur? Texting while driving is 6 times more likely to cause an accident than driving under the influence of alcohol. Sending or reading a text message causes drivers, on average, to take their eyes off the road for 5 seconds. When driving at 80 kilometers per hour, that means that drivers travel approximately the length of a football field with their eyes closed. At KBS World Radio, we value our listeners' safety and well-being. If you're listening to our programs while driving via your mobile device, please hit play before you set off on your journey. If you receive a message or a call while driving, either use a hands-free Bluetooth device to respond or wait until you've arrived at your destination. You're not just putting your life at risk. Distracted driving accounts for approximately 25% of all motor vehicle crash fatalities. Arrive alive.